The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. We at Word of Mouth, like so many people out there, have recently become big fans of the hip-hop musical Hamilton. Now, even if you haven't been listening to the soundtrack on repeat, you may remember a few facts about Alexander Hamilton from your high school history class. He was, of course, a founding father, the very first secretary to the Treasury, and he died dramatically after being shot in a duel. That was back in 1804, when dueling was a common part of the American experience. Jennifer Billock is a journalist, author, and freelance editor. She wrote about America's dueling history and some popular dueling spots from back in the day for the Smithsonian. And Jennifer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So duels followed a very specific set of rules. Can you talk a little bit about how you went about declaring a duel and what the sort of conditions were, what the rules were?
Sure, absolutely. So the set of rules that they had to follow was called the Code Duello, which is something that was brought over from Europe, but there were a few alterations made for the American duels. So basically, if someone was insulted and wanted to duel the other person, they had to issue a formal challenge. And that was usually issued through a person that they called their second, who was a person who basically like was their go-to guy to handle everything about it. So they delivered the challenge. They handled the logistics of the duel. They tried to settle it before anybody got killed or was bleeding horribly, things like that. So the second would issue the duel. The challenged would have to say yes or no. But the problem there was that if they said no, their reputation would be tarnished. So they pretty much always had to say yes.
Right. It was very honor-based, it sounds like.
Yes, definitely. And that was kind of the point of it, was to kind of alleviate problems of like rage killings and things like that. So,
right. The idea was not to kill people, even though you would think that a duel, the whole idea is for someone to be left standing and the other person is dead. That was sort of the opposite of the point, right?
Right, exactly. The point was really just kind of to settle the score as far as like maybe injuring the other person slightly or making them really nervous and scared. So yeah, the point was definitely not to kill people, not just because it was kind of the gentlemanly thing to do, but also because dueling was illegal in the majority of the states. So if you killed someone in a duel, you would be in a lot of trouble.
Did women fight in duels or was it just men?
You know, as far as I know, it was just men, but I kind of hope women did. Like, I feel like that would be empowering for them.
Yeah, sadly, I wonder if it was often men were dueling about women.
Yeah, that was a big part of it. There was someone who, like, said that this guy's wife was a liar and that started a duel. And then there was, like, someone who insulted the way that their wife looked and that started a duel. So a lot of it was romantic clashes.
There was another example you listed in your article where somebody was in a duel because of a steamboat speed issue, which I was wondering if he was mad that somebody else was going too fast, or maybe he was defending his own steamboat speed, or you know, I mean, hard to imagine killing someone over speeding, but I guess that's what we do today. That's the whole road rage basis. This is like the precursor.
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly, that was Francis Scott Key's son, Daniel. So he was killed in the disagreement about steamboat speed. And as far as I know, I think it was just they were trying to agree on what speed a steamboat coming towards them was going. And that was the big thing. But the really interesting thing about that is that it was Francis Scott Key's son.
Another question I had, were these mostly for the elite, you know, the aristocracy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was mostly the elite, the upper class that did it. But the first people that dueled in the United States were servants from Plymouth. So the lower class, I guess, started it, and then it kind of moved into a more formal thing, which was also something that came over from Europe. It was the majority was upper class, as far as I'm aware.
So you list in your article a few different popular dueling sites, and you can actually still visit a lot of these places, since so many of them took place on public lands. What do you think makes or made for a good dueling site? What were the participants looking for?
They were looking for something that was secluded, kind of hidden, because if it was illegal in the state they were in, they did not want to get arrested. They wanted to fight their duel and be done with it. So usually something like in the middle of the woods or out in a field along a river where no one ever goes. There's one called Bloody Island that was in East St. Louis-ish. And the thing that duelists liked about that was that it was considered neutral ground because it was an island in the middle of the Mississippi River that was not owned by Illinois and it wasn't owned by Missouri. So it was less likely that law enforcement would come there and find people dueling. So normally anyone who fought there was pretty much left to be.
What about some other famous spots? You know, where were some places that the duels were sort of stamped into American history?
Well, one of the main ones is Weehawken in New Jersey, and that's where Hamilton and Burr, his name Aaron Burr,
Aaron Burr. Yes, I will admit that I'm totally asking about that because I am addicted to Hamilton.
Yeah, I caught where you were going with that. Yeah, so Hamilton and Burr met in Weehawken, New Jersey. What happened there was that Hamilton had supposedly been insulting Burr behind his back, but Hamilton didn't agree. And so Burr issued the challenge and Hamilton accepted. They fought with guns. And that was when Hamilton was killed. He had a struck by the bullet in his spine and it stayed there until the next day. And there's still disagreements to this day about whether or not Hamilton shot. And also if he did shoot, whether or not he missed his target. So,
yeah,
like on purpose, not accidentally, but on purpose.
No, it's funny as I was thinking about, this spot Weehawken, which you can visit. And I'm wondering if that area may start to see a lot more tourism now that Hamilton, the musical, has become so popular.
I actually think it has kicked up a little bit because when I was doing research for this, the majority of the references to Weehawken were about Hamilton, the musical, people saying, oh, there's still this spot you can go to.
Do you know if there's an equivalent today of formal duels? We were talking amongst ourselves during a staff meeting, and I mentioned something about fighting or MMA, and whether or not that really is the same thing, or if there is some sort of formal code where we still have the legacy of the duel around today.
You know, I have not been involved in any, so I cannot say for sure.
Well, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, but I feel like maybe schoolyard fights are kind of like that. Like you were saying, professional MMA, boxing, things like that, like those follow a specific set of rules. That's probably the closest I can think of.
Right. Well,
I would love for someone to prove me wrong, though.
Yeah. Well, I guess it gets to your point where the idea was to give people time to cool off maybe and let, you know, less passionate heads prevail. So if you do that schoolyard fight where you say, all right, you know, 3 o'clock after the swings, you've got time to back down.
Yeah, that's true. I did actually, funny story, someone did challenge me to a schoolyard fight when I was in middle school, so I guess I have been party to it.
Well, I'm glad you didn't turn out like Hamilton.
No, she chickened out.
Well, Jennifer Billock, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, of course, thank you.
Jennifer Billock is a journalist, author, and freelance editor. We found her article, Discover America's Bloody History at 5 Famous Dueling Grounds at smithsonian.com, and there's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Pardon me, are you Aaron Burr, sir?
That depends. Who's asking?
Oh, well, sure. Sir, I'm Alexander Hamilton. I'm at your service, sir. I have been looking for you.
I'm getting nervous.
Sir, I heard your name at Princeton. I was seeking an accelerated course of study. When I got sort of out of sorts with a buddy of yours, I may have punched him. It's a blur, sir. He handles the financials.
You punched the burr, sir.
Yes, I wanted to do what you did.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Extraordinary minds, minds that work differently, can be a burden and a gift. Producer Aubrey Ralph knows this firsthand. Aubrey's own experience with bipolar disorder has made him acutely aware of how minds can shape and distort reality. And he discovered in this next piece that's especially true for people with schizophrenia.
When you're bipolar, you live with two different versions of reality. There's a version everyone else seems to inhabit, and then there's your own mood-altered version. When my mood changes, sometimes drastically, it's like shifting color filters on a camera. The same scene can look dark and gloomy, or way too bright, or somewhere in between. I've learned to try to ignore the shifting colors of emotion and focus on what's real. But there are other conditions that can mess with reality itself, like schizophrenia, which is a thought disorder. Being mentally ill, I sometimes wonder, what would it be like to be schizophrenic?
The way I describe it is like a waking nightmare, where you have all the bizarre images and possible things happening and the utter terror. But with a nightmare, you sit up and open your eyes and it goes away. Not the case with a psychotic episode.
Ellen Sachs is a professor of law, psychology, and psychiatry at the USC Gould School of Law, and she is also schizophrenic. When most people hear schizophrenia, they don't think professor, they think crazy street person, and that stigma and lack of understanding is one of the big obstacles patients face.
Stigma is really, really powerful. There are very few things that can shut down someone's life as quickly as everybody agreeing they don't have one.
That's Ed Irwin. He's also schizophrenic, and we'll hear more from him later. The word schizophrenia is made of the Greek words for split and mind, but it might be more accurate to think of it as a mind shattered, where the boundary between truth and fantasy can blur or dissolve completely. Schizophrenia has many symptoms, but the most dramatic are what are called positive. They're what the illness gives you, and you don't want them. They fall under the term psychosis. Imagine not being able to tell the difference between even the wildest idea and reality. One of Ellen's frequent delusions is that she used to be God. Joking, her husband once asked if she quit or was fired. Psychosis isn't something that's on or off, though. Ellen explained that it's more like a dimmer.
I'll have a transient psychotic thought. I've killed hundreds of thousands of people with my thoughts, and I'll just step back and I'll say, Ellen, that's just your illness acting up. Pay it no mind. Further along the spectrum, I have what's called social judgment, which is to say, I'm always aware of what other people will think is crazy, and I don't want to appear as crazy, so I just don't say those things. And if I can't help saying them, I go home and stay away from people. And at the far end, I'm crouching in a corner shaking, and that lasts for weeks. That hasn't happened in a decade.
I'm poison.
Do not betray us.
Things I touch are poison. People I get near.
We'll probe into your brain.
Probably the most well-known symptoms of schizophrenia are hallucinations, and they can be much more complex than you might imagine. Here's Ed again.
When you get really extreme, the human mind attached to the human body is capable of just about anything.
And anything that can be experienced can be hallucinated, including smells or tastes or worse.
You can have tactile hallucinations. Quite a few people are under the impression there are insects crawling under their skin. Very upsetting.
Ellen told me instead of voices, she has what she calls thought commands, as though the thoughts of strangers are randomly invading her head. Most of us have had a taste of this experience. Maybe you thought you heard someone say your name, or at some point caught a glimpse of someone you couldn't have seen. It may sound strange, but even when we're healthy, our brains create as much reality as they interpret. For most schizophrenics, these symptoms are only severe a fraction of the time, and with practice, can even be ignored. In fact, the positive symptoms aren't what cause the most harm at all. The much more devastating part of the illness are the negative symptoms. These are what schizophrenia takes away from you. Here's University of Wisconsin psychiatrist Ron Diamond.
Negative symptoms are when you lose motivation, you lose spontaneity, you lose creativity, you lose the ability to persist in something whether you want to keep doing it or not. And the loss of being able to motivate and to initiate behavior is often much more disabling than hearing voices or believing things that other people disagree with.
Mental illnesses can weigh you down in so many different ways. There's social pressure to be normal, to pass, but there's also fear about what could happen if you fall short. In rough times, jobs, families, and friends can all fall away, and then there's the possibility of ending up in a mental hospital. Generally, these are not places you want to be. I've avoided that, but many are just one episode away. Schizophrenia is also a lonely illness. Being in the bipolar community, I can hold up a list of heroes who have done amazing things, like Mike Wallace or Ernest Hemingway, but there's no real list like that for schizophrenics. This is in part due to the more debilitating symptoms that can hinder creativity, but also because of the negative public image the illness has. People who are doing well usually don't advertise their schizophrenia and certainly don't make the news.
When you walk up to somebody in the street who's panhandling and looking odd and behaving oddly, you say, oh, this person is psychotic. They must have schizophrenia. But when you go into your dentist, unless he or she has a big S on their chest, you don't realize that person also has schizophrenia. And when you go to the bank and the bank teller is behaving absolutely normally, you don't say, oh, that person has schizophrenia. So what we get reinforced with is all of the people who are doing most poorly and most symptomatically who are behaving oddly. And what we miss are all the people with this illness who, through sometimes significant struggle, are behaving pretty normally, fulfilling role functions, living their lives as best they can, with an illness that often makes that much more difficult.
So when you think about schizophrenia and other mental illnesses, please don't linger on the few who do make the news for doing terrible things. Think of the millions out there who we pass every day and don't even know it. They're people just like you, trying to live their lives, whose minds just happen to carry a little extra weight.
That piece was produced by Aubrey Ralph for Wisconsin Public Radio and the PRI show, To the Best of Our Knowledge. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. In 1991, Nirvana released their second studio album, Nevermind. It was a huge hit and is now considered one of the greatest rock albums of all time, so much so that I didn't bother checking Rolling Stone's all-time greatest albums list. It's there. Back when it came out, rock music magazine Spin didn't honor Nevermind with Greatest Album of the Year. That distinction went to Bandwagon-esque by Teenage Fan Club. She goes, says she's gonna get some records by the status quo. Oh. Chuck Klosterman was a writer for Spin back then. Today, he is a pop culture critic and author of fiction and nonfiction books like Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs and I Wear the Black Hat. In his newest, But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past, Klosterman tries to reverse engineer our view of history and apply it to today. He asks questions like, what song will define the rock genre 1,000 years from now? Who is the great undiscovered writer of the internet age? And is democratic freedom really all it's cracked up to be? It's a great read, and Chuck, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here. I gotta say, though, I wasn't at Spin yet when Nevermind came out.
I was still
a college student. That article did prompt me to buy Bandwagon-esque, which is a great record. Although if you're a member of Teenage Fan Club, you gotta kind of hate the fact that the main thing you're remembered for is being number one on a list no one believes.
Yeah, I have to admit, I had actually never heard of the band until I was reading your book.
Oh, really? Well, they're great. Yeah.
Does it alarm you maybe how misguided we are often when we're thinking about, you know, music or film or any of these things?
You know, it doesn't alarm me. I don't find it to be an alarming thing. I just find it to be an interesting thing. I mean, you know, in the present tense, we sort of view the world through the criteria we use for our sort of temporary measurement of greatness or importance. And it's a really fluid thing. It can change from like moment to moment. And then, of course, as time moves on, the history of ideas is basically the history of wrongness. And we look back at periods of time and we go, well, boy, they thought this at the time, but the real answer, of course, was X. And what I'm trying to do in this book is try to figure out what X is going to be, even if we can't see it now.
Right. So you come up with this principle, Klosterman's razor. Can you explain what that is?
Well, okay, if you talk to a policeman or a lawyer or a journalist about any kind of problem that isn't clear, that has no obvious solution, they will often say, well, you know, you look at Occam's razor. The clearest, most obvious response is the best response.
Yeah, the simplest.
Yes. But my philosophy is different. My philosophy is that when you look at a problem, the first thing you have to do is assume that your reflexive answer is wrong. That wrongness is built in to whatever you believe because everything about the past indicates that this is reality. That in all likelihood, the way we think about the world in the future will be a totally different paradigm than how we think about it now. So, of course, our conclusions will be totally different.
Yeah, so you apply this to music and literature and a number of things. You point out how many of our greatest writers weren't well known until years after they died. Herman Melville, for example, wasn't nearly as important in his own time as he is to us now. So how can you reverse engineer a process where, say, the next great American writer is maybe somebody we don't know at all?
Well, the short answer is it's impossible, and it's just kind of an interesting thing to do. But once you make the decision you're going to try it, this is what I did. I would pretty much go through people from the past that have emerged as meaningful. And I think to myself, what was the reasoning or the rationale we used when we look at history? And let's take those qualities, even if they seem a little awkward and unwieldy, and apply them to now. So, like you mentioned Herman Melville. There was a guy who, he was a commercially successful writer, just in the way that a lot of guys write books and make a living doing so and don't seem to have any meaning outside of themselves at the time they're doing it.
Right, he wasn't the great American novelist. He was just, an American novelist.
He was an American novelist, and he wrote Moby Dick thinking it would be his masterwork. And it got mixed reviews and didn't sell that great, kind of ruined his life. He became alcoholic and he died. Mm-hmm. And then it was after World War I, years later, that the book was sort of reevaluated as not just, a good book, but like the book, okay? So that's one case. Another possibility is like somebody like Franz Kafka, who was essentially unknown entirely. He had some confidants and there was a small circle of writers who knew him. But for the most part, he was an unknown person. And the fact that he was unknown really buoys his importance now because people can sort of project whatever they want onto him. He was like a clean slate. His work within his lifetime did not have any specific context.
Right.
So future people can create the context. So I started thinking, okay, well, this means that the greatest writer from this generation will be one of three candidates. It'll be someone who we think will be that person, who we already project to be that person, John Franzen or whatever, even though history says that never happens almost.
Hmm.
Or it'll be somebody who we know about but don't think of as important or who we don't know at all. And then the last two categories are sort of what I kind of speculate about and try to anticipate.
That's a tough job. It kind of makes me think of the musical Hamilton. We're in word of mouth. We're all big fans lately. And it makes me think of how he's being reframed as a much more important figure historically than he was even maybe, 5-10 years ago. And how you cannot predict how the society or culture or some person will change the way we think about, something from the past.
Okay, well, just imagine this. Imagine it's 1965 and you tell someone, we're going to change our currency. For one thing, we're going to put Harriet Tubman on a bill. And they would be like, what are you talking about? And then you go on further to say, for a while we thought we'd replace Alexander Hamilton. But we're not going to do that because he's going to be the center of a real popular musical. just see how crazy that seems. This is exactly what has happened, of course. But just this idea that a musical could impact how people will view money for hundreds of years in all probability is amazing. But that is the arbitrary nature of history. And, in many ways, I'm a critic, right? That's the main thing I do. I write novels and I write features, but I'm mainly a critic, And as a critic, of course, you're consumed with the idea of merit and what gives something merit.
Right. This is your job. You're assigning value.
Yes. And yet that is really only true in the present. In the present tense, we can live in this logical world kind of inside our own skulls. And we can say to ourselves let's measure the merit of object A against object B. But history doesn't work that way. History works in these strange sort of seemingly arbitrary, nonsensical ways that are also then jammed in to a logical framework. So in the future, when we talk about Hamilton having this impact on whose image is on currency, what we will probably say is not, it's so crazy a musical did this. We will say, well, you know, there was a musical about Hamilton around the same time that ideas like Black Lives Matter and identity politics was real central to the cultural discourse. And, you know, the entry of Harriet Tubman into the face of a bill had to do both with her being a woman and her being African-American. And Hamilton, you know, maybe we'll add some other thing that's not even going on. Like, you know, there was a realization that Hamilton had such an impact on how the treasury is created. It seemed like a paradox to remove him from this because so much of the way the treasury works is because of Hamilton's ideology. That's not really part of the conversation now, but it might be in the conversation in 100 years when people try to explain this in a way that isn't nuts.
Right. we'll justify it. We'll find a way.
Yes.
Yeah. How will history remember 2016 in 500 years? Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. I'm speaking with pop culture critic Chuck Klosterman about his new book, But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. So your book doesn't just deal with the arts. You also talk about what we may be getting wrong about science, about existence as we know it. And in fact, you got a chance to speak with the superstar astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who you said was mildly annoyed by your questions.
He was. And I don't want to overstate this. It wasn't like he yelled at me, but there was a slight adversarial tone to our interaction. And I think I know why. I mean, he's kind of become the face of mainstream science, right?
Right.
So he is the person who is always in these debates about climate change. Is climate change real? And I think I wonder if he thought, well, here's some guy coming in saying he's doing a book about, you know, collective wrongness. Is he just trying to disprove these things that his whole life is built on? If you ask the average person, do you think that the way we view a lot of the realities of science will be totally different in 500 years without giving them any specifics, they'll almost always say, you know, probably, you know, that seems reasonable. But you say that to a scientist, in a way, you are attacking his or her vocation.
Right.
You're suggesting that they're just kind of spinning their wheels and eating up time before we get to the real answer, which no one knows. I think there was a little of that in his response. You know, I talked to Brian Greene, who's another like high profile, like rock star, you know, physicist or whatever. And his take was, this is fun. Let's do it. You know, this is goofy.
Yeah. It's funny. Neil deGrasse Tyson was a little dubious of your premise. But then later, you know, he acknowledges this idea, which is totally crazy to most people, that we may be living in a super sophisticated simulation. He basically says, OK, well, that's not totally off the table. So, you know, he really does kind of come around to this idea that maybe we are wrong. He just doesn't want to totally put it out
there. Well, you know, the idea of all reality being a computer simulation, you know, that we're actually like basically all characters in the highest level version of The Sims that could exist,
right,
and that somebody in the year 3600 has created a game that replicates civilization and we're like the little pieces in that game. The reason this seemingly absurd, almost unfathomable suggestion is often sort of supported by scientists is because mathematically, the odds that we're a simulation are actually higher than the odds that this is real. And when you start bringing math into the equation, it's very difficult for a scientist to dismiss it out of hand because now science and math have this interlocked relationship, which was not the case until about the 1600s.
So you cover science, you cover the arts, you cover politics in a big way, in a sort of a very broad way. But I was wondering if you were tempted to apply the sort of thinking in this book to the 2016 presidential election.
Makes that complicated, okay? The premise of the book sort of is like, what are things that seem so natural and true to us that we don't even view them as questions, that we just sort of accept them as things that really aren't up for debate? So if you put it in the context of this election, that would be this idea that Donald Trump is a travesty and this is proof of the electoral process collapsing, or at least the GOP collapsing, which really maybe started with Sarah Palin's anointment as a VP candidate, you know, and this is the logical extension. So if we're really wrong about this, it would mean our view of Trump and the future of the Republican Party is actually going to be the opposite, that somehow Trump's emergence is the rational reaction to the way society is. And the move that the Republican Party has made ideologically is sort of a sensible, natural move. And in the present tense, that seems impossible. Like if we had a bunch of political pundits, you know, sitting here with us talking on the radio, it would be impossible for them to even put that in sort of a dialogue that would be like, well, okay, this might be what's going on. But now in 300 years, I guess, if we're really wrong about this, people will think about it differently because they'll have the benefit of seeing how the world unspools.
Right.
They also won't have the sort of day-to-day interaction with these candidates that we have. I mean, you know, right now, like the conventional wisdom is that the worst president of all time is James Buchanan. Okay, when I went to college, it was Grant, but that has changed. Grant's now like only the seventh worst president, according to historians. Buchanan is the worst president. But what was Buchanan like? You know, how did he seem to the people he talked to? Like you can read people's depiction of it, but we really don't know. This is an interesting thing about how Ronald Reagan will be perceived as we move further and further away from the 80s. And we'll get to a point where only a sliver of the populace will really remember his presidency. And as a consequence, they will forget a lot of the reasons of why Reagan was so popular. He somehow gave the sense that the 1980s were prosperous even if you were poor, you know, and all of these things that were not part of his content, but sort of just part of the way he presented the information. And as we move away from the 80s and people die off and new people emerge, we'll only be going by the content, and that will maybe change how we view him, you know? I mean, right now, there are people who would like to see Reagan, you know, on Mount Rushmore. I mean, there was a national poll where a large chunk of the populace said that. It would be difficult to imagine that in 50 years.
So yeah. What do you think, given all that you've done with this book, that your work, that this piece stands a chance of being remembered, you know, thousands, hundreds of years from now?
I would say almost none. I would say the only way would be is if some unusually specific prediction I make in the book, and I don't make a ton of predictions in this book, if one of the more dramatic ones proved to be accurate and it was somehow realized that I was the first person to pose this, I suppose then the book would have some kind of different life in 350 years. But then again, it really wouldn't be me. It would be that specific detail. It wouldn't be like they would go back and re-examine the entire book. I mean, I will be known as long as I keep putting books out. And when I stop putting books out, I will be unknown.
Well, we'll keep having you back as long as you do. So Chuck, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks.
Chuck Klosterman, pop culture critic and author of the new book, But What If We're Wrong? Thinking about the present as if it were the past.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. I'm a big science fiction fan, so naturally I've enjoyed watching the progress of Elon Musk's company SpaceX as they resupply the International Space Station and recently made history by successfully landing their reusable Falcon rocket on a drone-operated ocean barge. So when SpaceX announced not too long ago that they want to put an unmanned capsule on Mars by 2018, I was like, all right. But Sam Evans Brown, host of NHPR's show Outside In, who works about 12 feet away from me, overheard my excitement, and he was like, that's not going to happen. That's pretty much how it went down, right, Sam?
Yeah. I mean, I'm as big an Elon fan as anybody, but 2018?
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, what is the likelihood that SpaceX can make their 2018 Mars deadline? Well, Phil Plait is the science writer behind the Bad Astronomy blog for Slate.com, and he's here to help settle this dispute for us. Phil, how you doing?
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So, before we get into the details, whose side are you on in this?
Well, I want to be careful here and ask you, you know, you guys are arguing about this. Are you arguing about SpaceX's ability to do this at all, or their ability to do it in 2018? Or Sam, if he had said 2020, would you have felt better about this?
2020, you know, would definitely increase the odds. I definitely think that it's the deadline. I think he's going to blow right through that deadline.
Okay. Then I have to say that I'm probably on Sam's side.
Yes.
Okay.
Now let me be careful here, because you know, you just throw this out there, and if there's no background, no subtlety to the bet, you know, you got to be careful here. You know, the letter of the law is, I guess, what I'm arguing here. SpaceX, can they get to Mars? Probably. What we're talking about here is a planet that is tens of millions of kilometers away. It's a long way. And their Falcon 9 rocket, which is the rocket that they've been using now, 25 times they've launched this rocket, and they've been able to land the booster 4 times now. This is a pretty powerful machine, and it's excellent for getting things into Earth orbit. It can kind of sort of send stuff to Mars, but you're talking about an extremely small payload. You need a pretty big rocket to land a big payload on Mars. Well, SpaceX is working on that. They've got a rocket that they're almost ready to test called the Falcon Heavy. Really, it's 3 Falcon 9s strapped together. So it's got essentially 3 times the thrust of a single rocket. It's a beast. And that's what they're talking about using with their Dragon capsule. They've got an upgraded version of the capsule that they've been sending up to the space station. And that has retro rockets on it that can have it land vertically on the surface of Mars. And so technically and technologically, yeah, they can absolutely do this. The problem is they haven't tested the capsule yet. They haven't tested the Falcon 9 yet. They're planning on doing that all this year and next year. So the 2018 goal, I would say, is ambitious, to be polite. 2019, I would feel a lot more comfortable with, and 2020, yeah, I'd put $20 down. I'd put more down.
So do you think that the deadline is largely, you know, you said it's ambitious. Is it partly for the company to push towards a goal?
That could be. You know, I don't know the internal workings of SpaceX, that sort of thing. Musk does have a history of setting these pretty amazing goals. And while they get delayed, it's not necessarily his fault. Congress has cut NASA's budget to support this sort of commercial space ventures, instead putting that money towards the Space Launch System, which is NASA's internal big rocket system that they want to use to get to Mars. So this is delayed Falcon launches. It's delayed the Falcon Heavy. That's not Musk's or SpaceX's fault. So if there is a delay in this, you know, it could be due to any number of things. So the 2018 deadline, I think, like I said, it's that's pretty soon. They may or may not make that for any number of reasons. But, you know, give them a couple of extra years. And look, I am not betting against SpaceX.
You couldn't see I was gesticulating wildly there as you were giving that answer, because this is exactly my argument, is that he has this history of setting these wildly ambitious goals. And yes, he gets there, but it's always late.
I don't know if it's always late. I don't know if that's necessarily
fair. We're speaking in absolutes here, yeah.
It took a long time to get the Falcon 1 rocket, their first iteration, off the ground and up into space. Then the Falcon 9 was delayed as well, and there have been other delays. A lot of these just happen. I mean, nobody's done this before. No private company basically has said, yeah, we're going to start, in this case, literally from the ground up, build an entire fleet of rockets. And not only that, but do it at a fraction of the cost that other NASA contractors or other governments have been able to launch rockets into space. Pound for pound, SpaceX is doing it at a fraction of the cost. And if they can actually reuse these boosters that they've landed, they're going to save companies that want to send satellites up into orbit and all that. They're going to save tens of millions of dollars per launch. And so that's why I'm saying I wouldn't bet against SpaceX. I would bet against the deadline, only because it's pretty quick. But given time, yeah, my money's on SpaceX to land on Mars before NASA does, and possibly by quite a bit of time.
It's kind of interesting to me because, you know, there's a sense that landing a capsule on Mars is this fantastic achievement, and without a doubt it is. But, you know, I mean, we've done the Curiosity rover, not SpaceX, but, you know, we've put things on Mars before. So there was this part of me when Sam and I started to get into this argument that said, well, you know, if we've done this before, I guess they are breaking new ground. It also feels like we kind of know how to get to Mars.
Yes, that's true. And again, you know, I don't want to use that voice, but you got to look at the details here. Mars is actually incredibly difficult to get to and land a probe on. Literally half the missions to Mars have failed. And it's the United States, it's NASA, that has had a pretty good record of getting there, putting things into orbit or landing on the surface. And landing on the surface is really tough. And absolutely, they've done a fantastic job with the Viking landers, Phoenix lander, the rovers up to and including Curiosity, which is a massive beast roving on the surface of Mars. That's been pretty amazing. But it's a whole different story to put people there. If you want to put people on Mars, you need supplies and equipment that adds up to many, many tons. Right now, NASA can't do that. We just don't have rockets that can do that. The Falcon Heavy with the Dragon capsule will be able to do that. It'll land multiple tons on Mars at once. And if you launch three or four or five of these missions, you can not only put those supplies there, you can have redundant supplies there, which is kind of important if you want people to live. If your lander crashes or whatever happens, you want to make sure there's a backup. And so when I say that SpaceX will put this sort of thing on Mars, I think, before NASA does, it's that. And in fact, Musk has said this. He wants to put people on Mars by 2024.
Speaking of tough deadlines, I'm a little...
Well, you know, I think that's a reasonable deadline. I think that that's possible. You know, 2026, 27, that, you know, as soon as you push the deadline back, then it gets easier. But 2024, not out of the question.
Wait, Phil, can I make a bet with you about that one?
Well, I don't like deadlines in situations like this because you never know what's going to happen. A hurricane could come along. A single congressman can put their thumb on the scale and mess up legislation for SpaceX. So I don't like making bets on deadlines. But if it were something along the lines of, will SpaceX put a person on Mars before NASA does with the Space Launch System? Yeah, I'd put $20 on that.
Well, Phil, thanks for settling this for me. I guess my chances don't look good, but I'm going to stick with him.
I don't know if it's settled. I mean, we'll see by December 31st, 2018, if he does it, right?
All right, Phil Plait, the man behind the Bad Astronomy blog at Slate, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
The nutrition labels you see plastered on the sides of food packaging are getting a major overhaul next month, the first in 20 years. First Lady Michelle Obama, who has made fighting obesity a major part of her time in the White House, celebrated the upcoming changes in a press conference last month.
Very soon, you will no longer need a microscope, a calculator, or a degree in nutrition to figure out whether the food you're buying is actually good for our kids. So that's a phenomenal achievement.
Dr. James Hamblin is senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes the health column for their monthly magazine. He is less enthused about the new labels, and he joins us now to explain. James, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, why don't you just give us an overview? What is different on the new label?
The biggest change is an enormous number that is the calorie count, which is computed the same way it always has been. It's just presented three times larger. Mrs. Obama's comment about not needing a microscope. So that number is really large. All the other numbers are the same size as they ever were. The main differences in those lines is that there is now a distinction for added sugars, which comes below the total sugars, and that there's some changes in the serving sizes, which are meant to reflect what people actually eat instead of what the food manufacturers would deem to be a serving size. So they tend to err on the smaller size, therefore the calorie counts look lower, even though most people might end up eating two or three servings.
Right, so maybe one of those little bags of chips that looks like something you would get right at the grocery store counter and you would eat in one sitting. It used to say two servings, which may have been misleading. Now it's just one.
Yeah, you might say, oh, good, it's only 150 calories, I'll eat it. But then you end up eating two or three servings and not that little.
Right. So let's get back to the big emphasis on the calorie number. Like you said, it's much larger than before. You say that that's misleading. How so?
Well, there are ways in which it can be good, but I think people should also be aware that this is something that has been manipulated by food manufacturers in an attempt to make people believe that you can eat junk food if you just have it in small enough quantities, and that if you just eat a 100-calorie pack of Oreos, that's healthy, or that's fine. And in ways, it is okay, but if you were to compare, say, a 100-calorie pack of Oreos or a little pack of almonds, which has 150 calories, you might think, oh, I should just eat the Oreos, but that wouldn't be as healthy for you.
Right, I could count all my calories, fill up 2,000 calories with just Skittles. I already have a Skittle problem, but I could just eat all Skittles and say, I only had this many calories.
Yeah. And it turns out that would be really difficult to do because of the way that blood sugar would surge when you had the Skittles, and then you would get hypoglycemic, and then you'd want more Skittles. We all know these cycles that happen, and 100 calories just ends up being not equivalent between foods. So it's just something to be aware of when you're looking at what appears to be this one giant number, which is supposed to signal the quality of your food.
Well, speaking of sugars, and you're not alone in this suggestion. I've read a few different pieces that have said that this added sugar requirement is, for one, easily circumvented by food manufacturers, but two, kind of broadly missing the point. Tell me a little bit more.
Well, I think like so many of these numbers, it's just one data point that can be looked at in evaluating food, and it's certainly not perfect. A great example that I think of is orange juice versus cranberry juice. You could have orange juice, which is loaded with sugar, you know, just as much sugar as soda, but would have zero added sugars. All of the sugar is coming from the concentration of oranges. And cranberry juice, where cranberries are not a naturally sweet fruit, so you have to pour a bunch of cane sugar into there or high fructose corn syrup, and that all counts as added sugar. So if you were to compare those two things, the cranberry juice would get a big ding, have a bunch of added sugars, look really bad, but in fact, they should have very similar physiologic effects on your body.
Now, would something like a package of Oreos, in which, you know, obviously all sugar is added sugar, is that line just going to put all the sugar into the next line, the added sugar line?
You know, I haven't seen how that would look, but that seems most logically like the way it would be. Yeah, there's no natural Oreo. And it gets to a point where there are cases where that might be a helpful metric, but in the most part, it doesn't quite matter to our bodies where the source of a sugar molecule is coming from.
I read a few things that sort of point out this argument that, you know, that nutrition labels, the people that are actually spending time reading them and maybe analyzing them, these are the folks that maybe don't have as much a problem in the first place because they're looking to educate themselves. And I do have this feeling that no matter what changes were being made, there would be some folks saying, well, this isn't enough, or that we're focusing on the wrong thing. And I wonder if it sounds like maybe we want these nutrition labels to achieve more than any nutrition label really ever could, and this is sort of a substitute for real policy.
Yes, I think that all sounds very accurate to me. When I critique the nutrition labels, it is with an eye to helping people to make sense of these labels that they'll probably have to live with and deal with for the next couple decades, possibly, but they are necessarily imperfect. They're not going to achieve everything, and they are not a replacement for food policy that would make fresh fruits and vegetables available to people cheaply and easily around the country.
So overall, with these new changes, do you think that this just isn't as good as you'd like to see it, or do you think it is a net gain?
I think that the best argument that I've heard is that we don't have good field testing to know, and that this is a very serious public health measure with a lot of far-reaching consequences, that it would have been nice to have some test trials seeing how this might influence people before it became practically implemented. So it would be pure speculation on my part, but I think I don't expect them to have a major impact on the nation's obesity problem.
Well, James, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. James Hamblin is a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes the health column for their monthly magazine and hosts the video series If Our Bodies Could Talk. You'll find a link to his article for The Atlantic, The Number to Avoid on the New Nutrition Labels, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I don't eat no meat, no dairy, no sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school, my household smell like soul food, bruh. Curry falafel, barbecue tofu, no fish though, no candy bars, no cigarettes. Thanks for listening today. There's plenty of ways to get in touch with Word of Mouth. We're on Twitter, at Word of Mouth. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. We're not quite on Snapchat just yet, but we also do have a podcast that you can download through iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth will be back soon on New Hampshire Public Radio. No, strictly herbs and the sun, because I got melanin and drink water.
8 glasses a day, cause that's what they say.
They say you are what you eat, so I strive to eat healthy. My goal in life is not to be rich or wealthy, cause true wealth comes from good health and wise ways. We got to start taking better care of ourselves. They say you are what you eat, so I strive to eat healthy. My goal in life is not to be rich or wealthy, cause true wealth comes from good health and wise ways. We got to start taking better care of ourselves. Be healthy, y'all.